Okay. We're going to go ahead and call the tax committee to order. We don't have a quorum, Representative Liebling, so we can't formally move your bill or act, but we're wanting to get started anyhow. I do want to quick announce that Representative Hornstein requested that his bill be heard tomorrow. So if he came for that, it's not going to be heard tonight. That is 4078. So that won't, we won't be doing that one tonight. So, Representative Liebling, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for hearing this bill, and also thank you for moving us up on the agenda so that my testifiers could get back home a little bit earlier tonight. And so, Madam Chair, this is House File 3422, and this is a bill for a sales tax exemption for pollution control equipment for Rochester Public Utilities. And I'm not going to say too much. I'm going to let my testifiers explain the bill a little bit more for the committee. And I have with me Larry Koshier, who's the general manager of RPU, and Sue Parker, who's the director of corporate services for RPU. And I'm going to let Mr. Koshier start. He's going to explain the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Koshier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. Just a little background on the project. The original project was to provide steam to the Mail campus in Rochester. They were looking at expanding and needed additional steam for heating the building. Rather than build their own facility, which would have been in the order of $40 million, they came to us, and we had excess steam, so we wound up selling that steam. Not only did it save them capital investment, but it saved them about $2.5 to $3 million a year in cheaper fuel. You all know Mail. Mail has been a growing entity in Rochester. They added about 1,000 jobs last year in the community, and this project has helped them, you know, remain financially viable and growing. The team project that we have, of course, is between two nonprofit organizations, the City of Rochester and the Mail Foundation, and we certainly wanted to make that point. During this process, there was a lengthy process of permitting with the MPCA and discussions with the environmental community, and the RPU board decided to proceed and install an emission reduction project, the project which will reduce sulfur dioxide emissions and nitrous oxide emissions and mercury. So this is a project that we're actually coming before the committee to look for a tax exemption on. The project is about $37 million, and you know, we think it's a good project for the environment. We think that you know, that the project has positive benefits for, you know, for the health in the community, and is something that should be considered in terms of incenting these kinds of projects throughout the state, and especially this project in Rochester. We would like to, you know, to also note that the tax, the way it sits, the sales tax would tax the raw product that is being manufactured on one end, and where we generate electricity with it, the retail product on the other end. In 2007, the ratepayers in Rochester sent $4.7 million to the state as far as the retail sales tax goes. And we just think that taxing on one end and taxing on the other end with the same people paying for it is really not appropriate. The other thing to recognize is that we are levying a tax here on one political subdivision, which is, of course, the city, and to another political subdivision, which is the state. So, again, we really think that the state legislative intent is to encourage installation of pollution control equipment, and by taxing it on the raw product, and it's a disincentive to purchasing and installing equipment. And we'd encourage you to consider our request here to provide that exemption. Existing state statutes, do have a number of other exemptions for this kind of exemption, and I'll ask Sue to address that, here in a minute. But just to, kind of summarize the, the power control process is an integral part of our generating systems. It's part of the production system, and we encourage you to look at this as far as an exemption. And after Sue talks about some of the other exceptions there are in the statutes, we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. Probably wondering how we...
Pardon me, we want to get your last name.
Oh, Susan Parker.
Parker, okay, I apologize for that.
That's
welcome, Ms. Parker.
One of the questions you may have is how did we get here asking for an exemption after we've already started the project? We originally had thought that we were exempt under the capital equipment exemption, and then upon further study, we found the exception to the exemption that says accept pollution control equipment. We did meet with the Department of Revenue and went over the statute in detail to see if there was maybe a misinterpretation, and they had suggested we come here because it is pretty clear that pollution control equipment is pollution control equipment. Then we started looking at some of the other exemptions that are available, and we're handing out a handout, and hopefully you all have one. The first page is basically, that's it.
Yeah, we have it. The Rochester Public Utilities Exemption from Sales Act on the heading.
The first page was what we shared with the Department of Revenue and discussions about are we reading the law right? Is pollution control equipment really an exception to the exemption? The second page is where you're going to start to see some of the exemptions that are in statute currently. I'm not going to read them all to you, but there's a couple that I want to point out because they're very similar to our project. The first one is pollution control equipment purchased by a steel reprocessing firm if the equipment is necessary to meet state and federal laws. That's very similar to ours. We need to put in pollution control equipment. We will be getting the sales tax when we sell the products after that. The next one is about, I'd say, one-third of the way down the page. That one is about waste processing equipment, including pollution control equipment. That one, I think, went through a couple years ago for waste-to-energy facilities in particular. It's the same theory where you're not going to tax the input and the output. Those are the only two that I really want to point out. The rest of them are specific exemptions. When Larry said that the project was $37 million, not all of that is the taxable portion. About $10 to $12 million is the actual pollution control equipment and the portion that would be taxable. And that's approximately $860,000 if you're trying to figure out what is the impact for the state on this exemption.
Okay, thank you for that. Is there further testimony?
Just one other clarification.
Yes.
We talked about the federal regulations. I didn't want to get into the long process that we went through before the board finally decided to put in the emission reduction project, but certainly we foresaw the federal care and camera rules that we are scheduled to meet in 2009 and 2010, in addition to concerns about mercury. So this project is going to bring us in compliance with those federal regulations as well as mercury reduction. So it's a very good project for the environment.
I do have one other thing.
Please.
One of the others...
Wait it all day. We want to hear...
Yeah, thank you. Under the capital equipment, I'm sure you all know that it's actually rebated back to us after the fact, and this project won't be completed until probably May or June of 2009, so asking for that reimbursement is not going to occur until probably August, September of 2009.
Thank you for that. We actually have a quorum now, Representative Liebling.
Okay.
You'd like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 3422.
Representative Liebling moves House File 3422, and we understand you have an amendment.
Yes, I do. And, Madam Chair, I have the amendment, the A1 amendment, which just changes the date and makes it retroactive. For purchases made after January 1st, 2007.
Okay, thank you. So Representative Liebling moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the A1 amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Questions for Representative Liebling or her testifiers? Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, a question maybe for counsel. The whole concept of not allowing some capital equipment to be exempt while we have others, including pollution control equipment. Can we get a little history on that? I know, Mr. Michael, if you know about that or whatever.
And Representative Demmer, I think Ms. Parker, that's a great question because Ms. Parker highlighted that there had been a move to start taking these business inputs out, that pyramiding effect in the tax. And we've been getting away from that mostly because we don't have any money. But I think this is another example in that direction. But maybe Mr. Michael can or Ms. Dalton can help us. You know, there's been some progress.
Going up to the plate, so.
Ms. Dalton, Madam Chair, members of the committee, capital equipment right now is only an exemption for equipment that is used directly in the production process. And that dates back to, you know, when we were only partially exempting capital equipment instead of a full exemption for capital equipment. It was really truly aimed at the things that were directly used in the production process. So office equipment and computers and things like that also are not exempt under the capital equipment exemption. There was a move certainly in the 1990s when we had more money to expand the business exemptions, but that hasn't really occurred since 2000.
Representative Demers, I do think Governor Ventura tried, but I think kind of failed on getting those business inputs out, and I think Representative Hortman's bill took a shot at it this year that we heard earlier, and I can't tell you if this particular, maybe Ms. Dalton remembers if Representative Hortman did this in her bill. I don't know. Ms. Dalton, do you know if Representative Hortman in her bill? Nope. Okay, well, Ms. Dalton. No, okay. But Representative Demmer, I mean, I think, you know, we understood when we heard, I think, last year a bill on exempting capital equipment. I think we all figured out that's probably good business taxation policy to move in this direction. But Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Chair. I just agree. I do have a little bit of a extra incentive because this happens to be maybe some of my constituents that utilize this power, but in addition to going this direction, I think it's just good policy, especially when we're talking about equipment that would be used for pollution control and that sort of thing. You can almost make the argument for production, but maybe that's a little stretch. But I would just advocate for projects, this one and others like this, because I think it's a good idea. So I don't have a question. That was just in my comment. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Further questions? Or is there anyone from the public who would like to testify? Representative Liebling, and then Representative Earhart has a question. But Representative Liebling, you want to comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment, Madam Chair. Thank you. Well, first of all, I'm kind of disappointed that Representative Rukavina isn't here. Because of this pollution control equipment purchased by a steel reprocessing firm. I can't imagine where such a firm would be located. But anyway, but Madam Chair, in my first term, I had a bill actually to eliminate this the sales tax, that the tax that we have on local government. And I know this is something a lot of members are concerned about, because really what it amounts to is a shift from property taxes to the state. And you know, it'd be wonderful if we could get rid of all of this. And I know what I think I got about an $80 million fiscal note on my bill. And so obviously it's not something we can do in the short term. And I also then learned that there were some reasons why that had been put in place, although it seemed kind of irrational at the time. But when I look at the list of things that are exempted, and, you know, we've done this in a very piecemeal process over the years, and it does sometimes seem that it's a matter of, you know, who's got the political clout at the time and that kind of thing. And it would be, I think this is certainly a very worthwhile exemption, the one I'm advocating today, but I also hope that at some point we could take a look at this whole system, and if we can't eliminate this kind of tax altogether, at least try to see if we could make it a little bit more rational and have it be, you know, so that everybody doesn't be coming hat in hand and hope to have the right lobbyist to get the bill passed.
Thank you for that, Representative Liebling. Representative Earhart.
I'm going to pass, Madam Chair.
Okay, further questions? Anyone from the public would like to testify for or against this bill? If not, Representative Liebling, thank you. We appreciate your testifiers being here all day. We know it's a long time to sit around and wait, but thank you for coming. We're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you for that.
I don't want to do mine.
I'm going to wait a second here. Representative Hornstein, Representative Kelsey, Representative Olin. Is Representative Olin here? He's not here. We'll do mine. Okay, so we'll have Sandy's chair. Kind of a mess here.
Excuse me, I apologize. I'm looking for my handle.
There we go.
That was that right there.
Where is it?
No problem. I'm
all right. Carolyn Chesky, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair, if I may. I'd like to move House File 4168 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Great.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. Members, you know that what some of the things we've been working on for a while is this idea of how employees are classified as far as whether or not they pay withholding tax. And so we've been moving to ensure that folks who are independent contractors or being classified or called independent contractors are, if they're actually employees and should be paying withholding, we're trying to bring them into compliance, as is Congress, so that we are getting the tax receipts that we should be getting in our tax code. And so federal law has been moving in that direction. Minnesota's been moving in that direction. The Commissioner of Revenue has been moving in that direction here in Minnesota. And there's a section in the Federal Tax Code, Section 530, that provides a safe harbor or a grandfather for folks who have been calling independent contractors, but in actuality they're really employees. And they were provided safe haven provision that said, if you've kind of always been doing it, we'll kind of like to keep doing it. And I'm repealing that provision and saying that, no, if they're employees, they really should be treated as such in the tax code, and they're not independent contractors. And some of this work comes from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and we have, Madam Chair, a testifier from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, if you would permit her to kind of give us a little context on the
Great.
Thank you.
For the record, state your name.
Madam Chair, I'm Deborah Parker Janot. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I just wanted a few minutes to provide some context how this bill actually relates to a recommendation that we made in a report last November. We issued an evaluation on the extent to which employees in Minnesota had been misclassified as independent contractors and found that, in fact, 1 in 7 employers misclassified at least one worker in 2005. And as you know, that has important consequences for workers, for employers, and it also has tax implications. As part of that work, we looked at how the three agencies that are involved in making determinations of employee classification enforce the rules. And one thing that we found was that there was a lack of information sharing among Department of Revenue, and Employment and Economic Development, and Labor and Industry. One of the barriers to them effectively sharing compliance and enforcement information is that the definition of employee varies among the three agencies. And those criteria for making classification come from Minnesota law and rule, but for revenue, it also is linked to what the Internal Revenue Service says. We made a recommendation that the three agencies work together to define a common set of criteria about what is an employee for the purposes of Minnesota state government. And in fact, the commissioners of those three agencies accepted the recommendation and began to work immediately on that effort. But they hit a snag, and that's what this bill relates to. Because the Department of Revenue is linked to the Internal Revenue Code on the issue of 530, the safe harbor provisions of Section 530 in public law, the federal law, they're not going to be able to get quite in line, particularly with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, where there could be a great synergy in terms of enforcement and compliance activity between those two agencies. So to the extent that this bill addresses that barrier and would allow then revenue and deed to work more closely together in compliance activities, you know, we support that action. I can't speak specifically to other implications of this bill, but it does neatly fit in with the recommendation that we made.
Oh, thank you. Carolyn Chesky, do you have another testifier, or do you want to first take questions from the members?
Okay. Oh, no.
Any questions, Representative Broad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Coles and I were just asking the same questions, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but anyway. what I'm wondering, it's a little scary, actually, but what I'm wondering is how does this actually, does this put us in greater compliance with federal toward federal conformity, or does this push us away from federal conformity in terms of our tax code? Obviously, that's been something that you've talked a lot about and that we've spent a lot of time on, and I'm just wondering which direction we're going with this provision.
Ms. Dinant or Carolyn Chesson?
Well, I, you know, Mr. Michael, I think, is working on something there, but I would ask Mr. Michael to give an opinion on that. I actually don't know. I mean, it moves us in the direction of tax compliance, and I don't know if the department is here or Commissioner Inez, but I think they would have a viewpoint on that as well, and they have not shared with me what their thought is on that. But Mr. Michael, Representative Broad is asking about conformity.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I think you could characterize this as moving away from federal conformity in the sense that the withholding rules for federal income tax purposes will continue to qualify for this safe harbor unless Congress changes the rules, mm-hmm. whereas they will not for state purposes. So I'm assuming that federal law will allow employers to treat some of these will allow people who qualify for the safe harbor to be treated as independent contractors, even though the common law rule would normally say that they're employees, and assuming that the Revenue Department proceeds to enforce this without regard to the safe harbor, then those payments to those individuals would be subject to Minnesota withholding. So I think that's what my reading of the bill is. I don't know, you know, John Haugen, who's the lawyer that advises the John, I guess, is nodding that he agrees with that.
Representative Cole, for to that point.
Well, I was just going to follow up. Part of the reason for conformity is to try to minimize the confusion for taxpayers, and so I'm trying to figure out how this. I think that this goes in the opposite direction of, I think, a lot of the legislation that we've been trying to accomplish in terms of creating less confusion for taxpayers. But I'm also trying to figure out, Representative Lincheski, if these people weren't paying or weren't doing the withholding, are they just paying their tax differently? Are they paying their tax in a greater amount? How does this impact a regular, say you're an appraiser or a real estate broker out there and you've always been doing business this way, you've paid your federal taxes a certain way, is this going to increase your taxes? Is this going to just change how you pay your taxes? What does this actually mean for the real folks out there?
Madam Chair and Representative Broad, the bill doesn't change the tax base for the individual income tax, and it doesn't change who's subject to the tax. But I do know that you gave the example of the brokers, realtors. They're here, and they could tell you their concerns directly. I think I wouldn't want to speak for them.
Okay. We have a list going.
Oh, okay.
Are you finished?
No, that'd be great. Okay. If they can come down and testify, I'd love to hear it.
All right. Well, first, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Lincheski, you kind of addressed in what you just said the question I had, but I'm looking at the revenue note, and I see there's no revenue impact with regard to your bill. So I guess the question I have is why? I know that, or you mentioned earlier, you want to try to, you know, help with compliance. But if we're not anticipating any revenue impact, particularly if we're moving away from the concept of federal conformity, why would we do this? What's the policy reason to do this? Weighing the federal conformity issue and the fact that we're not going to, according to the revenue note, recognize any additional revenue by making this change.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Coles. Well, as you know, in this committee, we do a lot of things that aren't to raise revenue. And, I think the Office of the Legislative Auditor has explained what the intention is. The Department of Labor, the Department of Revenue, and indeed, are trying to determine worker status and have the same rules as to how worker status works. And from the 2007 report of the Legislative Auditor, they found that, in fact, they're all kind of doing a little differently, and they need to get standardized, and that will help us with our compliance. So my attempt here is to make it clear what the rules are and have those departments work together. I mean, there's a possibility that it could create revenue down the road, but that's not being booked here, and that's not my intention. I think Representative Broad has highlighted, you know, all the different objectives that we have in the tax committee, whether it's transparency or efficiency or equity or horizontal or vertical equity, or, you know, she's mentioned conformity, and there's merit to the stepping away in that regard as it relates to the federal tax system. You're mentioning adequacy of revenue, but my intent here was to standardize the law, and so therefore to help us with compliance, which is another objective of the committee. And we do have a billion dollar in tax gap that if we could get some conformity so it makes our system simple and it's possible to create revenue, but that, yes, nothing's being booked here. I would note, Madam Chair, if I may, also, you know, we don't conform on a lot of things, and it would be nice if we did, but we have not for the last 10 years. The tax committee has repeatedly chosen to not conform on a lot of things, and that's very bipartisan, whether it was the estate tax or Section 179. I mean, there are times we pick and choose in Minnesota, and my determination is that the compliance initiative and the standardization trumps the conformity piece as it relates to Minnesota in particular. But, you know, as you recall, when we passed our conformity bill on March 7th at the governor's signature, we had literally dozens of conformity pieces that don't cost money. So they're not always related to revenue. And so, you know, I think that it's a legitimate concern for members to weigh what is most important in our tax system.
I do have a list going, Representative Polk, on this point, or do you have another question?
Madam Chair, thank you. And maybe it's because I don't fully understand Section 530, which I'll be the first to admit. But I guess my question, given what you just said, Chair Winchesky, is if the goal is consistency across our state agencies, why don't we look to have the Department of Labor or Department of Employment and Economic Development adopt a definition with regard to independent contractors that or employees that's consistent with 530. Why are we deferring to what labor is doing or the Department of Employment and Economic Development instead of saying let's continue with some federal conformity here and have them conform to what we're doing at the Department of Revenue or with in the federal government? And again, maybe that's because I don't fully understand Section 530.
That sounds cold, Madam Chair. I absolutely don't understand Section 530 of the Federal Tax Code either. And I think that's where we are always, you know, we're all stuck. We can all look at the bill summary and read Mr. Michael's laying out what Section 530 of the Revenue Act of 1978 does. But yes. And Madam Chair, if you would like Mr. Michael to explain it to us, but I think the basis still falls with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And if you would permit me, Madam Chair, I think it's appropriate for the Office of the Legislative Auditor to take a whack at, you know, why not just do 530 for all three departments? I think it's a legitimate question.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there are a couple of issues in play here. One is the workers who are subject, who are classified as independent contractors under this 530 exemption, in all other circumstances, they're employees. And so I think you're going to have a difficulty at DEED and DLI with workers who, in fact, are employees now saying, okay, we're going to let you be treated as an independent contractor. There are tax implications for the unemployment insurance system. Eligibility for unemployment insurance is linked specifically to employee status. So if a worker is, in fact, an employee, DEED wants those workers properly classified and participating and the tax revenue coming in the unemployment insurance system. At labor and industry, workers' compensation coverage is also linked specifically to employee status. So there are important obligations, rights and obligations on the part of both employers and employees that are linked to that proper status. And in terms of income, issues, if I might just address that issue as well. There are some compliance differences between, in terms of income tax compliance. Those workers who are subject to wage withholding have much higher rates of voluntary compliance than individuals who are self-employed and paying income tax through that venue. So, to the extent that we bring people into their true employment status and treatment as employees, that provides a much higher tax compliance rate for Minnesota, generally speaking.
Madam Chair, one
Thank
final
you.
Question.
All right, Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, and maybe from for the witness from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, I guess the question I have, then, based on what you just said, is do we have a situation in DEED or in the Department of Labor and Industry where people are not paying into the requisite, into the workers' comp system or into the unemployment system because of the 530 exemption that exists under the tax laws?
Ms. Dunan?
Madam Chair, I think it's possible that employers who kind of picking and choosing which definition they want. I mean, there could be employers out there who, because of their 530 exemption, are considering themselves in Minnesota then exempt from workers' compensation and unemployment insurance obligations for that worker as well. Technically, it's possible to have different statuses for different programs, and that's one of the issues that we're trying to address here in bringing some conformity.
Thanks, I think, you know, We may or may not have a solution in search of a problem, but I appreciate the testimony. I appreciate what Representative Lachesky is trying to do here as well. But
all right. On this point, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Cole, I'll add myself to the list of people who don't understand Section 530. Yes, it's getting better all the time. But I think if you do read the summary that Mr. Michaels prepared, I think the reason that we don't have Dolly at all just to establish one standard is because even in Section 530 there isn't one standard. If you engage in certain occupations, it doesn't apply. If you were classified, if I'm understanding, I'm sure Mr. Michaels will, if I'm misunderstanding, I'm misrepresenting Mr. Michaels, I hope we're correct. If you were termed as an employee, then this is not available to your employer to reclassify you. But if you are new in the industry and hiring people as contractors, then it is available. So I think the point is Section 530 itself is inconsistent. And so trying to get these other agencies to be consistent, this is probably the most elegant way to do that. Thank you.
Carolyn Chesky or Ms. Dunod? Mr. Michaels, no comment? All right, still have a list here. Representative Tolbert.
Madam Chair, thank you. Obviously, none of us are experts on 530, but nor did I ever hear of it before. And I don't want to hear of it again either, I don't think. But my question is, and on going back to the conformity business, it seems to me that if an employer is somewhat forced under this language to conform to the correct status of an employee, as what I think the legislative auditor said we should be doing, that they're classified as an independent, but not really, they're really an employee, then it would seem to me that that would be an incentive for that employer to also say, well, I'm making a mistake. I'm obviously making a mistake from the state's perspective, and so why would I not then classify that employee as an employee under the federal court as well? So I think it becomes almost a voluntary type of compliance that I see as a push on the federal level as well. I mean, what we should be saying is if an employee is an employee by definition, and we want to be able to say then that employee should be defined as an employee and have the benefits of as an employee. I understand the testimony from the legislative audit, and if it puts us out of compliance with the federal government, I think so be it, but I think it would also push that employer into recognizing that they have an obligation somewhat to classify that employee as an employee under the federal government as well.
Thank you. Representative Mulroy?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Several of my questions have been answered, but it seems to me like 530 just completely doesn't make any sense, and why would we ever follow something like that? I think there must have been a lot of money that went to some campaign to get that through. Two of my questions you've answered, work comp and unemployment comp. The next one that's involved with this issue is prevailing wage. I think that's treated the same as work comp, I believe, with regard to independent contractors. And then there was the Nelson bill of last year that had independent contractors in the construction industry defined. And aren't they, I think they're all the mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. use the one definition that you're trying to get at. Is that correct?
Ms. Jenner?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there are specific criteria in Minnesota law that say that in the construction industry, any worker that meets these nine criteria, they have to meet these all nine criteria in order to be classified as an independent contractor. And there's also a new law on the books here that is instituting a certification requirement. So anybody in the construction industry that wants to act as an independent contractor has to be certified by Department of Labor and Industry. So it's a different subset, and we want that, you know, that would continue if this law were passed.
On that point?
No, Madam Chair. My understanding was
all right,
that way, and that was the Nelson bill that you were talking about.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm trying to understand this revenue estimate a little bit better, because it just seems logically that if there is all sorts of people non-complying or not in compliance out there, that logic would suggest that we're going to see revenue coming into the state. So for the revenue estimate to suggest that there's no increased revenue would suggest to me that there's not a heck of a lot of non-compliance. So I'm trying to understand the difference between what the revenue estimate says versus what the reality I'm being told is.
Mr. Michaels actually has an answer for everyone.
Madam Chair, I'm not Representative Broad. I'm not sure I have an answer, but I think the thing you have to focus on is the scoring rules that are used in producing these revenue estimates, which, I don't know, when you recall it, Dr. Wilson came and made his presentation. One of the things that they assume is that what they term 100% compliance. And so in general, changes in the law that don't change technically who's subject to the tax, but simply make it more likely that taxpayers will comply, will not show up on a revenue estimate. That's why, for example, if you recall in the bill that passed earlier this session that subjected some construction independent contractors to withholding, the revenue estimate for that bill is the same as this one, which is a zero. But there was a fiscal note that was produced by the fiscal note people in finance and revenue that said, we expect to collect $2 million in additional taxes from people who are not now complying, and so it showed up on a fiscal note. Cynthia Templin on this bill asked the department to respond on a fiscal note basis to what the impact of this would be. She can tell you, but my understanding of what they responded was, we'll need money to actually enforce this, to bring in additional revenue, but I think that they think that it likely would bring in revenue, but only maybe if you appropriate money for them to actually go out and get employers to do it. But Cynthia might be better to tell you about that. But that, I don't know if that helps, but it sort of provides a little bit of the labyrinth of how this money is coming.
I think you've made your point.
Well, I was actually just asking the question.
Yeah. All right. You know what? For me, it's a quarter to eight. So, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against? Keep moving.
Madam Chair, I'm
Representative Earhart.
This is a question for staff, I think, Madam Chair. Are the money that would be collected from a workers' comp and unemployment compensation, are they reflected as general fund money, and would they be reflected in this? So why would it show up here anyway as additional or...
All right, Representative Stover.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to put on my appropriations hat again and ask why we don't have a fiscal note on this one, as well for the other funds. We have a revenue estimate for the tax purposes, but we probably should have a fiscal note on this proposal as it deals with workers' comp funds and other funds.
Because, all right.
That's what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, if I may, I think Ms. Templin should... explain. Now, Representative Solberg sort of asking the same question Representative Broad just asked. So I think it's probably appropriate for folks to understand what's right. going on here in the world of revenue estimates versus fiscal notes and this bill.
Ms. Templin. Make a claim.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff for the record. I think if you pull out your revenue estimate, if you focus on the last paragraph, there is there's an explanation from the department that that mentions that if, well, under current law, if these the independent contractors are making quarterly estimated payments for their income taxes, and there are some independent contractors that are not. If this bill is enacted, I believe this last paragraph is saying that this law will pick up the revenue from these independent contractors that are now being classified as employees, and that could result in additional revenue. But I think what this revenue estimate should really say or is unknown, because the department is not able to provide a number of the number of workers and or employers that could be affected by this provision. Does that hopefully that clarifies the revenue estimate. There are department staff here to also respond to this. I should also note that the department, the tax research department, doesn't traditionally produce revenue estimates, but for this bill, they did. They don't do revenue estimates on compliance, what they consider compliance proposals. So this is something that was a revenue estimate that was kind of breaking new ground.
And Madam Chair, to represent Solberg's question, if I may, you know, in tax committee, though, we almost never have a fiscal note. And of course, you like them in your committee. And, you know, I think Representative Kahn's committee in compliance, if this were there, she may ask for a fiscal note. But we generally don't see a fiscal note with anything coming through here. But what's unique is, as Ms. Templin has said, to have research take a whack at this is a little bit different. But, you know, I, if I may, Madam Chair, I do want to say that, you know, I think it would have actually made this attempt to do some good policy here much more politicized by bringing revenue with the bill. And it would have been much more difficult to just look at the policy, because certainly we could all try to spend money. But I think having it before us as a policy change, we can have the debate about how it should have been counted, but I think I want people to recall that the Commissioner of Revenue testified on behalf of Representative Nelson's bill and these similar provisions. I certainly won't speak for him now because he is not here, and I do not know the Department of Revenue's position on this bill, but the continuum we've been on, we've had full support.
All right, thank you for that.
Madam Chair, I think the revenue estimate is probably correct. I think, as I read that, the fiscal notes would affect other funds other than the general fund as a potential effect. If I don't know if it would or not, it would be the workers' comp fund and unemployment fund as well.
Madam Chair, there is a fiscal note for this bill. It's preliminary, but it basically says the same thing as the revenue estimate, except maybe it has a slightly more information on the safe harbor provision. But it was not scored as raising any additional revenue. Again, it's very similar to the
the revenue estimate.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome. For the record, please state your name.
My name is Dave Diedrich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and thanks for this opportunity to comment on this bill. I should preface all my comments as well, saying that this issue is way above my pay grade, and I'm having difficulty understanding the public law myself. So what we did is we took this language and we submitted it to our tax professionals, and I asked for just some feedback, and this is just a summary that they provided with me, and I'm going to share that with you now, and I will be brief. One member mentioned that they would caution any attempt to create a solution where Minnesota has a different definition of wages than federal law, and that would cause several problems. Does an employer now have to issue a W-2 for state purposes and a 1099 for federal purposes? Employees are eligible for tax-free benefits like medical, cafeteria plans, etc. Independent contractors are not. Independent contractors can establish their own qualified plans. Employees cannot. Any deviation from federal law in an area as broadly intertwined with other tax provisions as wages is asking for trouble. This departs from the principle of federal conformity. Whether or not it's a change, this also burdens taxpayers by ignoring the reliance interests, and therefore it's bad policy for the very reason that led to the enactment of Section 530 at the federal level 30 years ago. Many taxpayers will tell you Section 530 of the public law does not provide complete safe harbor from challenge by the IRS. This was enacted in 1978 and has yet to find its way into the Internal Revenue Code. The IRS still challenges independent contractor status, even if the taxpayer believes they have met the supposed safe harbor test. The supposed tests have become more complex given all the litigation surrounding this area. And finally, by adopting this language, we do not see any advantage from a taxpayer's point of view. This will harm employers. And so I guess just in general, the Chamber opposes this language, and with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from members? Do we have someone else from the audience that would like to testify for or against? Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Susan Dior, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I, too, have to beg your pardon because I am definitely not an expert on this particular section of law either. So with that said, I, too, sent out this language, this bill, to some of our brokers and agents to see to get their responses, and I also got some responses from their chief financial officers. And how it was relayed to me essentially is that if this safe harbor is removed, that there is the potential for real estate agents to be classified as employees now. So that the broker would now be an employee, and an agent would be the employer, and then the agents would be the employees. What they indicated, of course, that, you know, would create a very new dynamic for our industry in particular. The bigger concern was how you would determine that for unemployment purposes. I know that was raised. In the real estate industry, we have about a 30% turnover year over year, every year. So people coming in and people leaving is about 30%. So their concerns, of course, were how, if they were to become an employer, an employee relationship, how that would be determined from the standpoint of unemployment issues, unemployment insurance, and whether or not agents could start obtaining unemployment. So there's a lot of questions we still have as well that I need to come up to speed with, but we greatly appreciate the opportunity to testify, and we'll certainly try to understand this further. Thank you.
All right. Madam, thank you. Any questions for members? Representative Mallory?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Diori, I don't understand that at all, what your testimony is. It's saying that this, which clearly doesn't control unemployment or work comp, how in the world would changing this to the same definition of what they're already covered by a definition of work comp or unemployment comp, they're already covered one way or they're not, and this isn't going to affect that in any way whatsoever.
Ms. Diori.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, it would change it if they became an employer-employee status. So right now they're independent contractors. So what was relayed to me was that in the event there is the potential. Now, I don't know, because of this, there's the 20-point federal test And then what I've, what Howard explained to me was that there's the safe harbor, there was these three issues, industry standards, the litigation, and one other provision that I can't remember off the top of my head. And what I understand is the safe harbor sort of answers the questions of these 20, if the 20 point standards from the federal level, sometimes it can go either way, and this was kind of the sense of the safe harbor provisions. So what's been relayed to me is that if the safe harbor provisions are taken away, there is the potential for a real estate broker to become an employer.
All right. Representative Mulray.
Madam Chair, my understanding, and if there's one of the people from the agencies in the audience, but my understanding, this affects your withholding, your FICA, and your FUTA, but it in no way affects, it doesn't change what our law is on work comp or unemployment comp. So this, a change here has no effect on that. That's already in the law, and they have to comply before and after this change.
Madam Chair, Representative Moy, you're correct. This bill doesn't change the law from the standpoint of workers' comp or how it's collected or anything like that. What I'm trying to relay is it would change it for real estate brokers and real estate agents, because we would move away, potentially move away from the context of an independent contractor relationship and into an employer-employee relationship. And so if that occurred, then they would then brokers would have to start collecting withholding and everything else.
Right. Madam Chair, I agree that if this bill goes through, you may have to, depending on the situation, you may have to do that, but it doesn't in any way affect their unemployment or work comp and what anything on that, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Mulley, correct. It's not modifying your law. What I'm trying to relay again is if a broker becomes an employer, it's going to radically change their relationship with the agent. Right now it's an independent contractor status, so if they become an employer, they're going to have to start collecting the FUTA and the Social Security withholding and everything else. And, of course, potentially all of our real estate agents could come in under the unemployment context.
All right. Thank you. Well, she's made her point twice. Oh. Does anyone else like to testify for or against? Well...
Madam Chair, I'm John Haugen from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll muck
things
up a little bit. As far as the real estate agents, there is a provision in the Internal Revenue Code that's very similar to Section 530, except it's called 3508. 3508, which applies to withholding and will still apply to Minnesota, says that if you're a licensed real estate agent and you have a contract with whoever is hiring you that says that you're an independent contractor, you get paid on commission, you are a statutory independent contractor, so you'll still be an independent contractor for withholding tax purposes, for state and federal. Even under this bill.
Okay. Real fair for that. Real fair for
that. All right. Hang on, Mr. Haugen. We have a question.
This is supposed to be short.
Actually, Representative Broad.
Actually, Madam Chair, I'm just thinking that this is a great argument to abolish the IRS. So I just, I wish Representative Paulson was here and he could carry that message with him to Washington, D.C.
All right. Mr. Haugen, you don't have to answer that. All right. Look at all the people we're attracting, Carolyn Chesky. For the record, please state your name.
Madam Chair, I'll be quick. My name is Kyle Macarios. I work for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, representing about 12,000 construction workers in the state. And Representative Cole asked a very good question earlier when he asked, is this a solution in search of a problem? And I just want to highlight another example, or a couple other points raised by the Legislative Auditor's report, which is that there is a very significant problem of employee misclassification in the construction industry. Unemployment insurance audits done over a two-year period, 20% of the audits performed in construction found misclassified workers. And when you break that down a little bit, in some areas of construction and commercial construction, where many of our members work, It was 28% of the audits performed had misclassified employees. In drywall, where many carpenters work, 31% misclassification, and in roofing, 38%. So the very, very significant problems, and particularly when you look at another point raised by the auditor's report, which is that those contractors misclassifying their employees as independent contractors and paying them as independent contractors can save 26% on their labor costs. And so when you put yourself in a construction industry, when you're in a competitive bidding situation, if you are playing by the rules and employing employees and complying with the law, you're at a 26% disadvantage over somebody who is cheating and not paying workers' comp insurance or unemployment or Social Security or withholding taxes. And that is, one of the problems that we have been trying to address through numerous legislation, why we support this legislation. So I wanted to bring that point forward.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Macario. Any questions for members? Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify for or against? Woohoo! With that, Chair Lentiski lays her bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you. We want to call up Representative Graskowski's bill, who's been patiently waiting. I think we all found out that Representative Wolfschlager is not a night owl. Didn't we all pick that up? She doesn't want to be here, so. Representative, who would like to move this bill? I apologize, I don't have a number in front of me. Who said that? Representative Cole would like to move House Bill 3338 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Representative Cole, it looks like Representative Graskowski has an amendment.
That looks like a great amendment.
Yes. Chair,
move the
A1
amendment.
Representative Cole moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Madam Chair.
Aye. You want us to put it on, please?
Actually, I'd like to hold off an amendment.
Oh, okay.
Is that okay?
Representative Cole will withdraw his amendment. All right.
So he wants to lose his bill.
We have a habit in the tax committee. We don't force people to explain their amendments. We just put them on and we start the bill. So, Representative Graskowski, to your bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me explain a little bit about the amendment. Or maybe I should explain the bill first and then quickly the amendment and the position of the amendment. Flood relief legislation and the disposition of the housing assistance was accomplished largely, and that process is largely complete now within the southeast Minnesota flood area, was accomplished through the use of mortgages. There are 10-year mortgages on the houses, and they're forgiven after 10 years. But this issue was brought to me by the Winona County Recorder. And the question was, Representative, why are we collecting mortgages on, why are we collecting the registry tax on mortgages for disaster relief aid? And it amounts in Winona County anyway to about $53 per mortgage. And so we put a bill together to prevent this from happening again in the future. And that's the way the bill lies before you as it is. I talked to the Senate author a few days ago, Senator Ropes, who put it through the Senate side, and it is in their tax bill right now. However, they did make some changes to the bill, and the amendment was an effort to conform this bill to what they have over there. But as I look at it, it's problematic, the amendment is, because actually the mortgage taxes have been paid in the flood zone by the local HRA, who is acting as an agent for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency in deploying those mortgages. So, to actually refund those people really wouldn't work because they didn't pay the tax largely in Southeast, I think completely in Southeast, actually. So I would ask that the committee would entertain this bill for being laid over for inclusion in the tax bill, and that we work out the differences in conference committee and get things straight at that point.
Okay, thank you for that. Questions for Representative Drazkowski. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions? Or Representative Rosalina?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, what did you say about the, who paid the mortgage tax?
The local HRA Representative Rosalina paid the mortgage taxes, and I think that the majority of that money actually came from disaster relief money from Minnesota Housing. But of course, the HRA is the agent that is getting those mortgages out there to the flood people.
Well, Madam Chair, and members and representatives, I have always, and I've been here 22 years, and I have always supported every natural disaster that happened in this state and every health catastrophe. And but I look at this, and you want the local mortgage tax forgiven. And we had, last Thursday we had a bill on the House floor for mesothelioma and finding out why it's happening up in my area and Representative Solberg's area and Representative Dill, who isn't here, to our constituents. And you and others wanted us to spend our local property tax money. So I guess my question to you is, how do you rationalize what you're trying to do compared to what you wanted me and Representative Solberg and the rest of the Range delegation to do, using our local property taxes to pay for a health catastrophe in our area?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would point out, Representative Rukavina, that the way the bill lies now, it's forward-looking for the next disaster. It has nothing to do with the current disaster in Southeast, and it is an attempt to avoid this type of conflict in the next disaster in Minnesota, wherever it is.
Well, Representative members, I would point out that the state of Minnesota, you already got paid for this, first of all, so I don't know if the local HRA paid with state money, but I would point out that I believe it was 3 weeks after the flood, this state came together to help southeastern Minnesota with, I believe, what was about a $50 million state appropriation, and the Fed was probably 3 to 4 times that. And my constituents have been waiting for relief for 2 years. It's 2 years later, and I still can't get $4.9 million for a problem that some people know has existed for 30 years. And there are people sitting over there that wanted me, including you, to use my local property tax to pay for a health issue that's a catastrophe to the people that I represent. So, again, how do you rationalize that? What seems to be different treatment of people in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Drazkowski. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, I don't know how you can actually draw the parallel, but I can tell you this, that the environment in Southeast among the officials that came to me and said, Representative, this isn't really in the spirit of flood relief aid when we've got effort to get money out to help people. It's not in the spirit of flood relief aid to turn around and say, well, a portion of it has to be used, or, a portion of it has to be used to pay the mortgage tax.
Representative Rosalina?
Madam Chair, members, I've supported flood relief when there was a catastrophe in the Red River Valley, and I've supported this relief program and everything else, but it seems that, I think the bill is asking for, $40,000. I don't know how it's spread over 4 years.
It goes forward.
An estimate on the mortgage registry tax being forgiven in an area that had a catastrophe. It deals with, home ownership and addressing that issue. But yes, me and Lauren and Dale and Curtis and Bob, Thomasoni and Bach, our constituents, are supposed to pay out of our local property taxes for what was a promise. We came together as a state 3 weeks after
It's been 2 years since the Department of Health knew about these extra 37 deaths, and we still do not have the money to find out why people are dying. And it upsets me, that's all. It's really nothing to do with your bill, but to me it just seems kind of a good parallel to draw. Because, as I said, there are people sitting over there that wanted us to use our local property tax office to pay for an issue that not only 2 years later to address the representative, but for a year and a half, the mining companies that some of your members said maybe should pay, but we don't know if they're to blame yet, knew about before me and Lauren knew about it, and our people knew about it. And I think that's the issue that you people have failed to realize and accept, and the governor even has failed to accept. In a letter in June 12th, I believe it was, he told us that he was sorry for what happened, it was right what happened, and he was going to work with us. And he didn't work with us until the day that bill was on the House floor. And I do not understand why we have to pay our local property tax dollars, which is what those dollars at IRRRB are, and other people who have been treated fairly and should have gotten the money. It could cost a million, $153 million state money, out of the voters' for. But people come here and they want a little more, and we were asking for $4.9 million to do a study that should have been done a long time ago. That's
okay, so we've got Representative Mulery on the list, but Representative Solberg and Dammer are to that point. Representative Solberg?
Mine is not only to the point, but to the bill itself, and I was all postponed my...
Okay, to that point, then Representative Dammer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I can't resist, especially after it was specifically pointed out. There was pointed this section, but specifically pointed out. And I guess the only thing I would offer is the same thing I said on the House floor. Nobody disagrees with the fact that we need to do the study. The difference is, Representative Rucamino, that I could see, and the distinction I made, is that there is a fund that is specific to the range, and in statute it specifically says that the dollars in that fund are for looking at potential and or suspected medical problems or issues related to medical issues in the mining area, and that's what this mesothelioma was about, because that's what we think it was about. And if it was found that that was not the case, it was something different, fine. But this whole issue came up because it's on the range, and that's what that fund was for. There is no fund for Southeast Minnesota flood disaster. There is no fund for crop disaster. There is no fund for those. But there is a fund in one of the funds. If there's no numerous funds that I'm aware of in the range, but one of them specifically said it was for medical problems that arose to be studied. It specifically said in statute that it was for. That's where we thought it should have been paid for, because that was designed for. And my people in southern Minnesota and throughout the state, the businesses that would be paying for the study would be kicking in if it found to be that was the case. But this is a problem that was found up in the range, and that was what that fund was for, and that's why it's different.
We could be into that point.
Slowly, Representative Demers, but you get me. We took $250,000 of our own money to jumpstart this based on a letter we got from the governor that he was going to put money in.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying? We took money out of that fund. It's a quarter of $1 million, as we should have, my ass. Where does your local money come in for this? You had a catastrophe that all of us support. I told you that fund was created 30 years ago here in state law, because it used to be a general fund tax that funded the IRRRB, and it went from a general fund tax to a local tax. What would be going to my schools and cities and communities and his counties and everything else? That's where it comes from, to get siphoned off before it goes there. And they had to get the votes to pass that. They had to put a lot of things that the mining companies and others wanted in law to get it. I contribute money from Grand Marais, Minnesota to Aiken. One day I clocked from my mother's and dad's house to Aiken. It was 110 miles away, and they never had a mine in Aiken. And yet they were getting more property tax relief on their home tax and a homestead credit than the entire city of Virginia that's surrounded by three mines. And I have tried to discuss this for years, but nobody wants to hear it because it's some special funds we got. So we took, again, $250,000 out of that fund to jumpstart this program. But nobody, to this point, 2 years later, Representative Hammer, has given us any help to finish the jumpstarting that we did.
Representative Hammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm sorry I've got Representative Rukavina so excited. But I guess what I would suggest, if we don't want that fund to be used the way it was intended, the way the statute says, maybe Representative Rukavina, you need to introduce a bill to change the language so that we don't have to look at using that for what it was intended.
Well, Madam Chair, to that point, if it wouldn't have been available to use, we would never even have the potential to jumpstart. And the governor would still be working about, and we'd still be worrying about. Mm-hmm. You should thank us for having four years ago, the flexibility to be able to do that and to jumpstart and having the courage to jumpstart it based on some conversations with the governor. So that argument is just bogus in my view. Instead of taking pots at us, you should be thanking us for having it. But Madam Chair, Representative Demmer said, well, there's no crop disaster program away. Father, it's called the federal government.
That's not what I said.
He said there's no fund for crop disasters.
Exactly.
He said there's no fund established for crop disasters.
Ma'am.
And I've said for years that we should take a portion, if the farmers were smart, the check off and put it into a fund like the IRRRB for economic diversification. And they still should be doing that. That's what wise people before us did with the IRRRB account. You say that there's no fund for flood relief. There's always been a fund for flood relief in the state. You know, the federal government says that the states are supposed to pick up, I think, 15% and the locals 10%. We've always stepped up to the plate. We did in southeast Minnesota. More than ever in any other flood, we appropriated money. Some that are sitting there unused because they can't use it. And we're looking at saying, well, you know, one person came to me and said we should be taking that back this year. I said, well, let's have some flexibility in the law and give them time to be able to use it if that's what it's supposed to be used for. And we'll worry about it a couple of years from now. Because there's millions of dollars there that probably will not be used. But we should allow that community the flexibility to be able to use it. But Madam Chair, if I got the floor, since this is going forward, it seems to me we should have some kind of amendment that says, as just Representative Skalski described to us, that the state paid the mortgage deed on refinancing. The state didn't pay the mortgage deed on my refinancing. And I know people are hurting on it, but they didn't have to refinance all their current debt. We should not be, the state, the housing authority should not be, or HUD should not be paying mortgage deed on a refinancing a loan from the state. I didn't know that existed in state law. So if this is going to be put in law, I think what we should do is have some kind of a law that says we're not going to pay for the mortgage deed from state funds for refinancing. I mean, I think they got a better deal than I ever thought that they would ever have. I didn't know that was what the state funds were being used for.
Madam Chair?
Well, Representative Demmer is on that point, and we've got... Did you want
to... Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think comparing the federal crop disaster program to a fund set up in state statute is a bit far-reaching. But I'm not going to go with this tit for tat anymore, Representative Madam Chair. The woe with me that we're hearing about is unfortunate, but we need to get back on Representative.
Woe is me.
That's healthy.
Okay.
That's what you started with, Representative Rukavina. Madam Chair,
Representative Demmer has the floor. Representative Demmer.
Thank you. We're talking about the bill that Representative Drazkowski brought, and Representative Rukavina is talking about not supporting this because of something happened with them. So I think that's getting a little far afield, Representative Madam Chair, and I'm going to let that go.
Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer, we're going to go to...
Point.
Yeah, I'll let Representative Rukavina respond. I just want to say something, and Representative Drazkowski, this is why Tax Committee is such a great committee. I just want to jump in here because, you know, I just... all members know that when you have a problem in your district, it's you can't imagine that it's not the biggest problem in the world. And I think this is reflect it reminds us all that when legislators are not willing to come to the assistance of others, feelings are hurt for a very long time. Or when legislators make other people pay taxes and are not willing to contribute themselves, people's feelings are hurt for a very long time. And we, all of us, have a very long memory. So it's just a good reminder that all of our votes are linked to one another in many ways. And I think we're seeing this play out, and I understand Representative Rukavina is really upset, and I completely see why. And I understand that. Representative Rukavina.
First of all, Representative Demmer, I never said I didn't support this bill at all. And I never said I didn't support flood relief. I said I supported every flood relief. And to your point that your businesses were paying the $4.9 million, do you think that $53 million dropped out of the sky? Do you think some of that was corporate income tax? So my businesses helped pay for that too. Mm-hmm. But your woe is me attitude is absolutely astounding to me that you would even publicly say that. You know, if I never need a heart transplant, I hope I have yours, because you obviously never used it.
Representative Rostowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then we also have Representative Mallory Marquardt with questions. Representative Rostowski.
Okay, thank you. I would just like to point out to members that, again, this bill is forward-looking. It attempts to put into place reimbursement for tax for the mortgage registry tax, but to provide an exemption so that it's never collected in the first place when the recordings happen. If the disaster in those future floods, which I think is probably going to happen given Representative Pawlowski's bill, is delivered in a similar way so that the mortgage taxes aren't collected on those particular mortgages, in the flood or other disaster that may happen in any of your districts. I'm bringing this together as a contribution to good policy, I think, down the road in the future, in a future disaster. Again, the way this bill is written has nothing to do with the Southeast disaster.
Thank you for that. Representative Mallory, then Marquardt. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Try to get back close to the bill, although I thought somebody said there wasn't any fund for crop disasters, and there was even most or a large part of Texas got crop disaster funding for an exploded space shuttle, which really affected almost nobody. But back to the real bill, Representative Drazkowski, my understanding is that the if it's the local HRA or whatever it is, that they advance the mortgage registration tax and other closing costs. But my understanding is those are wrapped back into the mortgage and they're eventually paid off by the mortgage order. Isn't that correct?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't understand that to be the case, Representative Mallory, but you may have a piece of information. I don't. I just know that I've talked to the HRA director in the past, and he said that they were paying this we're paying for it. He wasn't real sure whether it was going to come out of their existing funds or out of the flood relief dollars.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mallory.
To continue on this, why would this be any different from a non-federal disaster area? If we have a disaster area, I remember working on those as an attorney in St. Paul and things like that, and there was funds from exactly the same situation. The money was put in for these refinancing, and money was advanced for the cost, and then they paid them back. Why would we make any distinction just because this is a federal disaster area? There's a lot of other disasters that happen with the exact same type of thing going on, and I don't see any point in making a distinction between these.
Madam Chair?
Representative Rostowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mallory. These mortgages are put out as 10-year mortgages. They're 0% interest, completely forgivable as long as the individual lives there for 10 years or more. So I don't know exactly how it could be recovered in the mortgage at that point. So my sense is that it's not being rolled back in.
Representative Mallory.
We also have some of those here in local situations also. So I guess if we're going to do something, we better apply it across the board, not give certain areas certain breaks that we're not doing to others. That would be my view.
comment? No?
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Rostkowski.
Thank you. Representative Mulry, I would just suggest when I put the bill together, I was trying to find a place that just made intuitive sense of how to put the bill together. I don't know if you've got a suggested amendment for another way to differentiate. I think we need to be responsible and be certain that that the events, whatever it is, rises to a level of need in terms of a disaster. To be presidentially declared certainly does that and provides that differentiation rather handily. So that's why it was written the way it is. Again, it's forward-looking. It could be in anybody's district this year, next year, or the year after. But I can tell you that just going through the event and the discussions around these, there just was a real sour feeling in the area of why is the state collecting mortgage tax on disaster mortgages?
Representative Mulry? No. Representative Marquardt?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and this issue on what Representative Rukavina brought up, I need to comment on. I listened to the debate on the House floor the other day, and I should have said something, and I didn't. But it bothered me because in my area along the Red River Valley, we have suffered from real disasters in Browns Valley and Breckenridge and East Grand Forks and so forth. And when we came forward, no one asked us to pay a local share. And I'd never seen it before that I had seen on the House floor and even today where we're quibbling over whether or not something's in state law. And when a legislator has come before us asking for help on a disaster, and I think 57 deaths is a disaster statewide, that we said, nah, you pay for it yourself. And I just, I think we're one Minnesota, and I just don't understand that at all. And because, on these floods, there's been hundreds of millions of dollars, and I think we were asking for five on that, or 4.9 or whatever, and it's, if I had 57 deaths in my area, I would consider that a state disaster. And we're going to be listening to another bill, Madam Chair, with Bovine TV. Mm-hmm. And there you have cattle and deer in Roseau County, and yet we're looking at statewide funding for that. Why don't we just make Roseau County pay for that? It's their problem. I don't understand it because, Madam Chair, I've benefited from the generosity of this state and other legislators helping out, and I really think kind of the debate that's happening today and what happened on the floor Thursday was really unfortunate, really, really unfortunate. And I think when a legislator comes and says, I have a disaster in my area, that we as a community, we as neighbors, and we as state legislators should come forward and help. And I understand what Representative Rukavina is saying here, and it's unfortunate we even have this debate. I do have one question for the representative, and you might not have this information, but I'm just kind of curious. Would you happen to know in a flood-related area what might be the average household income and what might be the average home market value? Would you happen to just generally be able to? I know you might not have that right now, but you wouldn't be able to give me a ballpark figure what that might be.
Representative Rostkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt. I would not. I can tell you that the floods were flash type floods in nature, and so they cut across very expensive houses to very, very inexpensive houses and everything in between. It'd be really difficult to take a stab at that.
Thank you, Dan.
Even a slave wouldn't do it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Further questions? Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have to set the record straight about a couple of things. I and others on our side of the aisle made it very clear the other day that the study needed to be done, and I said specifically the state needs to pay for it. That was not the issue. The issue was what pot of money do you take this from? And what was being proposed we didn't think was the appropriate thing to do, taking it out of workers' compensation funds for the whole state. It seems to me that this could have been, this study could have been funded in House File 1812 very easily, and it wasn't. And that's a choice that you folks on the other side of the aisle made. We didn't object to the study. We thought the study needed to be done. I said the study should be paid for by the state. We were objecting to the pot that you were taking the funds from. So let's be fair about this.
There was a study going on as to the salmonella, I believe it was from the ice cream, whatever it was, in March. It was paid for out of the special comp fund. What's the difference?
Well, Madam Chair, that point was not made the other day.
I said it.
Well, I didn't hear it. I didn't see the evidence of it.
That's because nobody wants to listen when it's done. That's the kind of thing.
Well.
I'm landing. Further?
Enough has been said on this.
Okay. Well, I think it's
Madam Chair, and I apologize to reference that policy. Because you got caught in the middle here. Welcome to the question. You all welcome were over there.
Yeah.
Same thing. Voted for the $2.5 million that you voted for me, use our local money, and my question is why. Didn't need to pick on you. It was kind of fun. You're in the deck.
I've got a built-in vote for Vest, Representative.
And Representative Drazkowski, and you know, there's just a few freshmen on this committee, but and I think they're not here right now at the moment. But you're a freshman, so I'll just tell you that everybody here has a really long memory, and everybody remembers who stuck it to who. And you know, I think we had a nice little segue on Representative Rukavina's bill, and it was happening within your bill. But I think there are still many things to be resolved before the honest tax bill. You have an issue, Representative Rukavina has an issue, and I think Representative Rukavina is, you know, is right to point out his need to have the state step in and solve this problem. So we appreciate that you have a problem as well, and we've had a nice discussion. Maybe not so nice, but we appreciate you bringing the bill forward to us today. Yeah. I would just point out
that, you know, this bill is not, I mean, this is an attempt to put our state in a better place down the road. It's not, I mean, it's not a regional problem. It's an effort to improve policy based on experiences from a regional problem.
Thank you for that. Further questions or comments? Anyone from the public, for or against? Yes. Representative Rukavina.
I want you to know that my 87-year-old mother said one of my biggest problems is I don't get anybody.
Yeah.
So.
I didn't raise Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's. They forget everything except the judge.
Well, and that's okay, because sometimes good old fashioned guilt helps people do the right thing when they should do the right thing. So there's no problem with that. Further discussion? If not, we're going to lay over this bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members for the lively discussion.
We have another bill.
As Representative Olin is coming down,
yes.
I don't recall if he's had a bill in front of the committee before, but I'm wondering why he's shaking.
Actually, you know, Representative Cole, Representative Olin had his property tax piece of this bill heard at Representative Marquardt's committee already. So, yeah, you haven't gotten to see have Representative Olin. So now after Representative Drazkowski, welcome. Hour and 15 minutes. Well, these are different provisions now. These are completely different. Okay, so Representative Coonan moves House File. Sorry, where is it? 4181 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Olin, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you've already indicated, parts of this bill were our tax credits on real property issues, and I will go into them if you want me to, and I imagine Representative Coles has wanted me to.
doesn't care. Okay, well, I won't unless there's a question that comes up.
And the members of the Rep. Olin's bill on the property tax pieces was heard in division already. So we're going to focus on the non-property tax pieces.
Okay.
Rep. Olin.
The non-property... Thank you, Madam Chair. The non-property tax provisions are a few basic ones, and I'll take them in this order. There's a provision on capital gains, which is probably the earmark of this exact bill. Because what we're trying to do by the bill I have tomorrow is to buy out the cattle in the area most affected by bovine TB in an attempt to be able to eradicate the problem by getting rid of deer and by getting rid of cattle in the area. Like, deer is a whole different issue, but that's being done. But the goal is to get rid of it, and the easiest way to get the cattlemen to cooperate is to get it so they don't have a major tax repercussion looking them in the eye, as has happened in the first instances. And I'm going to give you a couple of specific examples. Back in 2005, the very first incident that occurred in our area had the voluntary buyout provision forced by the United States Department of Agriculture, because he had one cow tested positive, your whole herd's got to go by USDA rules. So he got rid of it. Well, then, all of a sudden, he looks at the tax implications, and had he not gone back into buying cattle again, he would have been looking at considerable tax implications, because he's independently wealthy on other positions, which is irrelevant in the long run, but in his specific case certainly entered into why he rebought cattle in the exact same area where he had already had trouble once. So that's why this provision exists on the capital gains, to get it so people will have the incentive to go into the cattle or sell their cattle out under this voluntary buyout and stay out of it until the area is TB free. Now, I think your tax figures that you were proposed go to probably 2010. I wish I could tell you 2010 is going to take care of the problem to get them back to bovine TB-free, but it may well be 11 or 12 by realistic standards by what the USDA requires. It's just as a secondary thought, so they may have had to go a little further. But that's the main reason for capital gains provisions. The TB testing provisions that are also in this bill were full within the split state area and 50% for the rest of the state. As I understand, looking at my income tax return this last year and not even realizing it till I was looking at it, there is already some provisions on TB tax credit on those testing on those on the income tax return this last year, because I hadn't even realized it till I did my Minnesota return and I saw it before. I'm a cattle owner, I'm not. The third provision that goes into here is a fencing provision, which originally, the way it reads, would have affected the entire state. Fencing provisions that would have went into effect in last year's tax bill never happened, there was a lot more tax repercussions by that provision than was originally thought by ourselves. My intent, I do have an amendment here, but rather than pass the amendment out, I would like the committee to consider a fact that the actual expenses to just give the fencing provisions only to the bovine TB area as defined in statute, and I refer to the exact number I can provide, and not necessarily, as I understand, as a sales tax, because as I understand, there's some problem doing a sales tax, but as a rebate or refund or something other than a straight sales tax. The numbers that I've been provided is probably 9,000 to 10,000 actual costs over 2009, 2010, 2011, I think is the numbers that I was provided in the fiscal update for that. That is basically what the provisions of the tax bill are as presented. Like I said, the centerpiece is a capital gains to try to get people to cooperate with a voluntary buyout so we can get rid of this problem. And I'll stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Colbert.
Senator, under federal law or under the law that we're proposing, if my herd is affected by TB and I do a voluntary buyout, can I go back in and buy another herd right away? or am I required to be cattle-free for a certain length of time?
Representative Warren.
Madam Chair, Representative Solbert, as a presently existing federal law was, you could go in and buy them out right away. As the Minnesota law goes, affecting those involuntary buyouts, you will be forbidden from buying back cattle on that property until we're bovine TB free.
And Madam Chair, is it specifically for the farm is bovine TB free, or the whole affected area is TB free?
Representative,
Madam Chair, Representative Solbert, it's specifically for the farm in the contract that he's signing to agree to get the voluntary buyout. The terms that could be set in by the Board of Animal Health on the provisions of the 4075 bill that we'll all be seeing tomorrow does give the Board of Animal Health authority to control cattle sales into the area and out of the area.
Madam Chair, then, is one way I could get back into the cattle business is to erect the big fence? Or do I need to have the land itself or the soil tested for TB as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, if you sell out by the provisions of tomorrow's bill, the 4075, you will not, under any circumstances, be able to get back in. If you want, because you're signing a contract saying you're going to go out to the area as bovine TB free.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's the most important issue, because that's the thing that does affect the capital gains tax. And we need to, I think, I don't know what the fiscal impact of it is, but that's an important aspect of the tax bills coming forward.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg and other members, I'd also like to comment on the federal part. There is legislation that's being promoted in this Congress, but I'm not privy to know exactly where it's standing or whether it'll ever get through. But there is an attempt to take care of the same situation in Congress.
Thank you, Representative Mullen. Representative Coles to that point, and Representative Leland votes to that point. Yes, Representative Coles.
Sure, that was actually my question. What's the status in terms of federal capital gains and those issues on the federal side? Actually, Representative Mullen doesn't know. I don't know if Mr. Michael or staff have any sense as to how this is treated on the federal side. But I think it's a huge issue that you need to address and pay attention to.
Madam Chair and Representative Cole, I'm aware that Congressman Peterson is working on it for sure, but like I said, I'm not sure what exact has happened.
We'll ask Mr. Michael, he might know. I actually was flipped him a note asking if we've ever done a capital gains tax exemption for a crisis for anything, and the answer was no, state level. Now you're asking on the congressional level. Mr. Michael, do you know if any idea in the bovine world what's going on with capital gains? Or anybody from the Department of Revenue over there might know. I don't know, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, if you're asking about the status of this legislation, I don't know anything about that. I guess, you know, I think the point is that they can't do a like kind exchange because of this prohibition on buying or putting more cattle on the property. So the normal out that an investor would have, which is to replace the property with similar property that qualifies under the like kind exchange rules, would not be available to them.
Okay.
So that's why they end up with a liability. Now, there is an interesting quirk in federal law. If you're a low enough bracket taxpayer for tax year 08, 09, and 010, the tax rate on capital gains is zero. But in order to qualify for that, you have to have income low enough to be in the bottom, one of the bottom two brackets.
Okay. Do you have something to say?
Madam Chair, the only other thing that they could possibly qualify for is, depending on how threatening the situation was, it might be considered an involuntary conversion of the cattle herd.
Okay.
And in that situation, they could defer the gain and not report any gain as long as they bought replacement property within 2 years from the end of the tax year that they got the proceeds from the involuntary conversion. This would be, so that's what, you know, this provision has a thing where if they don't buy replacement property after the it's TV-free, there's a recapture in the minute there's an add-back. So the thinking at, from research was that most of the people who are going to take advantage of this are going to be replacing their herd. They'll probably be optimistic and think they're going to be able to replace within the 2 years for federal purposes. So therefore, there'd be no gain that we'd be subtracting anyway.
Oh.
Yeah, they might be wrong. And then 2 years down the road, they might actually, if they didn't replace the property because it's still TB infected the area, well, then they'll have to pay the feds, but they still get the subtraction for us.
Madam Chair, in an ideal world, that's probably what would happen. Unfortunately, knowing the five steps of TB and what that we dropped from free to advanced, accredited, now down to modified accredited, which means we're two steps down. It takes 2 years to get out of each one of those steps. So we're looking at a minimum 4 years. And all the dairy cattle, or all these producers in that area are pretty well being told by Dr. Hartman and his staff that you're looking at 4 years.
Okay. Further questions on this bill? Representative Marquardt, then Dabney. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I think Representative Olin answered that, but I do want to commend you, Representative Olin, for bringing this forward and championing this bill. I know you spent a lot of time with it, and I was being very sarcastic when I said this was a Rosal problem early on. So, but I want you to describe, and I think you just did, what impact does this have on the state and dairy farmers? What's the extra that is going to happen if we don't do anything as we move down these classes? It is a statewide problem. So what's the situation there?
Representative Olin.
Representative Marquardt, Chair Lynn Chesky, that's the best question I can think of answering right now. The impact, what's happened to the entire state now since this has happened, is as of today, or as of last Wednesday, a week ago, we are all at that modified step I referred to, which is two steps down. What we've somewhat been told, and behind the scenes, Dr. Hartman is working on a split state status of under 325 herds. 325 herds would be in an area which obviously covers my county. It covers parts of Beltrami, Marshall, and Lake of the Woods County. But that's pretty much all it covers. The USDA, who controls the whole situation, hasn't promised anything. But what they have told Dr. Hartman is, your request seems reasonable, especially in light of the fact you're trying to force the voluntary buyouts and the provisions you're actually taking. So the USDA is encouraging us and saying, we might let the rest of the state out because you're taking these provisions. So these provisions are actually just as good, if not better, for the rest of the state than they are for the people affected by it.
Okay. Representative Dabney, are we on that point, Representative Olin?
Madam Chair, I think it's important also from the statewide perspective. I think in Michigan, they can kind of put their head in the sand a little bit and said, well, this is a kind of a local problem, you know, let them solve it. And I don't know if I have the numbers right, but I think from the state coffers now, is spending $100 million a year attempting to eradicate it and TB, and that doesn't include all the private monies that people are losing because of that. We need to address this aggressively now while we got the chance. Otherwise, you know, every part of the state is going to be in deep, deep trouble, and we have an industry that's on the cusp of having huge problems.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, I'm going to make one comment on Michigan. Their problem started 12 years ago. They have been spending about $100 million a year. Minnesota is trying to hopefully get this entire problem resolved with approximately $7.75 million, some of which is being thrown in by the Cattlemen's Association, realizing that it's in their best interest to go along with a dollar charge. Now, the other thing from a Michigan standpoint, and this is not even dealing necessarily with the cattle, this is dealing with the the deer industry. 28% of the people in the state of Michigan that were surveyed said they were less likely to travel to an area with bovine TB, period. So what does it do to your district where you're in? Severe harm.
Representative Dabney.
Pass on, Chair, my questions have been answered.
Further questions? Anyone from the public would like to testify for or against this bill? If not, we are going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Owen. And members, Representative Solberg moves the minutes of April 9th, 10th, 14th, and 15th. Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adjourned.